You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
What's up, Launch Street? Tamara here, your host and that person at the restaurant that asks, do you have a gluten-free menu? I know, super annoying, right? Here's the thing. In my travels, I meet a lot of entrepreneurs, and everyone tells me they are doing something different that's going to revolutionize the category. But in truth, it's rarely the case. I hate to admit it, but it's true. But then I met this guy, Henry Schwartz. He is the co-founder of Mob Craft Beer. And there is a reason the word mob is in the name. Their entire business model puts the customer in the driver's seat. They crowdsource, they test, they crowdsource selling their beers. It's so incredible. Pay attention to our conversation somewhere in the middle about how they leverage experimentation of a new idea. I think it's something we tend to see as risky, but they figured out how to make it part of the process. Now, Henry is an imaginative futuristic. That's his innovator archetype. That's how he naturally innovates and brings innovation to his work and life. That means his innovation can be found in the blank spaces, and he tends to be forward thinking, solving tomorrow's problems versus worrying about yesterday. You'll hear him talk about how using data to predict, so futuristic, helped him stand out in a crowded category. This is a podcast to drink to. Ha ha ha. Henry, it's so good to talk to you again. Thanks for stopping by Inside Launch Street.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Well, I've had the pleasure of meeting you in person, but for those Launch Streeters who have not met you yet, what's one thing they'd be absolutely surprised to learn about you?
Probably that I had very, very large dreadlocks and backpacked to 37 countries before I graduated college.
Oh, my goodness. I don't even know where to start. Do I start with the travel or the dreadlocks? I don't even know. Well, I want to dig into another thing in your past because I heard you share this story and I thought it was so cool and just indicative of that entrepreneurial mindset. So before we dig into Mobcraft and beer, will you share the story I heard you talk about your first skateboard passion and how that turned into a store?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, a lot of everything that goes super well in any child's life, you can attribute to your mother. And there's definitely a little bit of that in this story as well. I probably picked up skateboarding when I was in fifth grade or so, and I grew up in Lakewood, so just outside of Denver. And
I didn't know that. I'm in Denver.
Yep. Oh. Yep. So I was just over in Green Mountain.
Yeah.
I had a bunch of great skateboard buddies. I had launched my first successful venture, which was Henry's babysitting service, and I made $1,000 over the summer.
Ooh, that's pretty good for babysitting.
Grader. Yeah, yeah. So I was super excited with that. And then this passion for skateboarding came about where we were going through a lot of skateboards, you know, as they break when you're pretty rough on them. I decided I was going to go buy blank skateboards and spray paint my own skateboard company's logo on them and sell them for a couple more bucks than I bought them for. So, you know, it was going into that summer of sixth grade that we were, you know, buying and selling some skateboards. And, you know, it was this business aspect pairing with my passion, because that's really all I wanted to do was get on that skateboard and ride it, and to be able to find a business that you could develop even at that young age, and it was a blast. So fast forward another year, I painstakingly get pulled out of Colorado. My mom's going to go back to Stout to go to a university up in Wisconsin, and I had to come along because I was obviously
no choice.
I pretty much had no choice. So she said, you can go back home in 6 weeks if you don't like it, but I have a feeling you're going to have a blast. So I instantly, you know, go to the skate park there, find some skateboard friends and, you know, instant matches that you can hang out with and associate with other kids. And then the end of the summer comes, freshman year, before going into high school, there was this opportunity for me to go out and get a job. So there was a local skateboard store in town that I went and asked for a job at. And the guy said, you know, hey, it's not going so well. We're probably going to have to shut down the doors, so I can't give you a job. So I was a little, you know, bummed out about that. And I went back and told mom, and she was like, well, why don't you try and buy the store, Henry? And I was like, what? How? Mom, I'm 15 years old. How could I buy a skateboard?
I love your mother.
This is ridiculous. And she's like, Andrew, you love skateboarding. You know, I know you can follow your passions and you'll be successful. So I took out a little tiny mom loan to be able to buy the rest of the guy's inventory at, you know, a little bit of a discount. And for the next 3 years throughout high school, moved that business from, you know, a little tiny, probably 12 by 15 foot store to one that was closer to 45 by 30, and, you know, quadrupled the inventory that was in there, brought on new product lines, built a skateboard team, did a 50 minute full length skateboard video that we premiered, and just, you know, had this awesome time living my passion, but also, you know, doing a business in that as well.
That is, first of all, I love your mother. Can she just give me advice all day long? She sounds like she knows what she's talking about, number one. But I love the opportunistic view on life. And I think oftentimes that's what makes us great innovators, whether we work inside a company or for ourselves, is seeing the opportunity where others see gaps or they just see the challenge. And you've done that through skateboards and then dreadlocks and now beer. So let's fast forward to beer. You and I met in Madison, Wisconsin, in the early stage symposium where I think, as we talked about, super impressed with how you approach your business. And yeah, I mean, I'm in Colorado, as you know, so there's a ridiculous amount of microbrews out here. But you're really the first to put the consumer in the driver's seat the way you have. So will you talk a little bit about your business model, how that works, and kind of the success you've had because of it?
Yeah, definitely. So we live by the tagline that we turn ideas into beer. You know, and we didn't think of that until like last year, which is kind of ridiculous. We were trying to explain it through 100 different ways, and at the end of the day, that is what we do. We get ideas that are submitted by people from around the U.S. Each month, we take one of those ideas and turn that into a beer. So that goes the whole length of, you know, building the formula, building the recipe for it, designing the labels. Whoever wins this voting round comes out to the brewery and brews the beer with us.
Oh, cool.
Then we have an awesome release party where we'll usually go down to their favorite bar, whether it be in Fort Collins or California or here in Wisconsin. And then we'll celebrate that beer idea coming to life.
So let's back up and break it down a little bit, though, because I think, you know, many of us are used to submitting ideas, but you're really, I guess, crowdsourcing the entire process. Is that the right way to say it?
Yeah. So from the idea standpoint, it's really anywhere on the idea spectrum of I like this flavor plus this flavor. Can you turn that into a beer? Or I had a beer that was, you know, this awesome banana bread beer, but it was 4% ABV. Can you make one that's 8% and I want twice as much chocolate in there? So it's, you know, really any idea that could come through. And what we've done to kind of weed out the dirt and worms beer is set up a little algorithm that tracks the social popularity of each beer across the internet. So when people submit ideas, they're given a unique URL. However many times that URL is shared around, puts it in rank of the most socially popular beers that we have on our site. And then those top 8 beers we put into the vote each month. And that's where it gets interesting on the business model standpoint is we kind of work like a crowdfunding campaign at that point where each beer is backed by people who want to see it be brewed.
Oh.
So you'll commit to purchasing either 2 or 4 bottles of that beer ahead of time. And if your beer wins, you'll buy those bottles. If it doesn't win, better luck next month, I guess.
So there. What has your experience been like? What are some of the lessons you've had along the way to go from startup to the success you've had today? And I'm particularly interested in not just from being an entrepreneur, but also from launching it with a unique business model in a pretty crowded category.
Yeah, yeah. I would say, you know, first off, Wisconsin's really different than Colorado, you know, so there are a lot of breweries down there. When we started, there were probably 40 breweries in the whole state. Mm. I mean, there might be 40 breweries in downtown Denver for all I know
right now.
Right,
that's like 2 blocks of Denver, yeah.
So, I mean, I think we definitely hit it at a good time. We launched the concept for the brewery in 2011 is kind of when we were in college, thinking through it, building the business plan, doing the minimum viable product. And then we first went to market in 2013. So launching at that point in time was, you know, I can attribute to some success. I definitely wouldn't launch a brewery right now. You know, the market's a little crowded. But then also above and beyond that, a big part that's kind of led to our success and frustration at some points is how we can get beer out to people. A lot of breweries operate traditionally within I make it, I sell it out of my front door, or they might sell it to a distribution company. But we've figured out how to work with online liquor stores such that we can get people beer directly to their door when they vote on the beers online, which is something that not too many other breweries do.
Do you think one of the keys to success for you guys has been your distribution model? And part of the reason I'm asking is I find that with a lot of innovators out there, they have these brilliant ideas, but then the innovation stops at the product or service and they wrap it up in the bow the same way their competition does. So they never even really get the chance to showcase how awesome whatever it is that they've built because they go to market in the same way as everybody else.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head there. That's even some problems that we're seeing internally in the brewery right now. Are doing that. You know, we've got aspects of the business that do follow a traditional distribution model. How are we buttoning those up that are different? How can we stand out above, you know, the other breweries that are doing the exact same thing, getting beer to the customers in the exact same way? So out of our business, we operate three different businesses realistically, and we did not know this going into it that, you know, we're going to have a bar right in the bottom of the brewery. We're going to have to learn how to run a bar.
Right.
You know, number two, we're an e-commerce company, so we have to know the ins and outs of e-commerce. And then number three, we're a manufacturing facility. So when it comes down to all the permitting, all the regulations, and the physical, you know, getting beer through traditional wholesale is the third part of our business.
Now, how many... I don't know if you have to share direct numbers if you're not comfortable, but I'm curious how many people are in the crowd sourcing, naming, tasting. Like, how big is that population? Because I know that they're a loyal group.
Yeah, most definitely. So this month is batch number 50, which is pretty sweet that we're hitting our silver anniversary.
Congratulations.
Of crowdsourced beers. But our customer base is definitely varied. When we first started out, we could only have people pick up in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And then there were some changes in Wisconsin laws where we could ship, and then some changes back that we couldn't ship. And then now we finally have our, you know, 30-some states that we can get beer to. So we're definitely seeing the most positive growth right now in the company. Users on the site, we're up at about 13,000.
Oh, wow.
And then we get about 500 or so each month that are actually getting the beer. So there's a big gap between how many people have created accounts and submitted beers. So that's something that we're definitely working on closing.
Well, and that process is kind of a funnel too, right? You go wide and then you start to narrow down and narrow down. Have there been any flavors that won that you thought, really?
Yep, you bet. So, and I often play this game on my tours when I give tours of the brewery. You know, I'll give people two descriptions of beers that both sound putrid and make them guess which one is going to be the winner. But in the sake of time, I'll fast forward to the best, weirdest one. There's a fruit called durian. Are you familiar with it?
No.
It's kind of dubbed the king of fruits. It's a Southeast Asian fruit, but it also smells like rotting flesh.
Oh, awesome. That sounds amazing.
And onions. I mean, it's a very, very putrid fruit, but it tastes like this delicious tropical mango custard. So, you know, we're getting ready to brew this beer, you know, and the guys who submitted it were from outside of Madison, and one of them was a home brewer that, you know, thought our concept was silly, so he was just trying to throw us for a loop. And then his other buddy, you know, bought a bunch of it to make it win. So this was pretty early on where you could buy like 24 packs and you'd win the voting round. So we're stuck with having to brew this durian beer. And Andrew, who's my business partner, is the microbiologist. So he understands all the chemistry behind flavors and, you know, all the compounds inside fruits to make them behave as they do. And he goes, you know, durian, that just stinks because of, you know, sulfur compounds that are inside the fruit. And sulfur has a relatively low boiling point. So all we need to do is bring this up to about 160 degrees and we're going to volatilize off all the durian throughout the brewery. And it's like, all right, Andrew,
okay.
You sound like you know what you're doing. So, you know, he makes his little double boiler so he don't scorch it and, you know, brings it up to about 160 degrees. And the whole brewery smelled like an egg bomb went off. It was just disgusting. But, you know, what was left behind was this nice tropical mango custard type of a flavor. And the beer style was a Pilsner, so it paired really pretty well. And it's one of my favorite beers to date as far as, oh, my God, we pulled this off.
First of all, it sounds disgusting and amazing all at the same time, which is hard to do. But, you know, I'm curious about this. You know, there's a lot of experimentation in the way you set up your business model, right? You've got people submitting stuff. It's all over the place. Then you got to figure out how to source it. Then you got to try it and see what you can actually make happen. Mm-hmm. How do you view experimentation, failure, risk in your business, given you've really set it up where that's a part of it, just a part of the process?
Yeah. Well, there's, I mean, so many great questions there. The first part on mitigating your risk for completely new brews, right?
Yeah.
So these beers are ones that we've never made before. When it comes down to it, brewing is definitely art plus science. So there's a portion of it that is strictly, if you do this, this will be your desired outcome. So we've brewed every style of beer that there is. You know, we've formulated recipes for a stout, a porter, a lager, a strong ale, and we're, you know, pretty solid on those recipes. When we're making adaptations for different flavors, you know, we can back off different ingredients into the beer to substitute for those flavor compounds we might be introducing. So if we're making a really sweet stout, then we're going to add raspberries and chocolate on top of it. Yeah, we might want to change our mash temperatures a little bit so it dries out the beer a little bit more so that raspberry and that chocolate pops. And we do that kind of repeated between the different brews. And when it comes down to actually piloting the recipe, we'll usually do a test batch of it on our 10-gallon system just to make sure that we're not wildly off. And the final addition of all the ingredients never happens in one complete sense. We've got the beer fully fermented out and finished, and say if we're going to add cacao nibs and cayenne pepper, we're not just going to say, we think we need 50 pounds of this and 20 pounds of this and dump it all in and go from there. We'll usually take some beer out of the big tank, blend a 5-gallon batch to make sure the proportions are right, then we'll scale up into that large size.
So I love about what you're saying, Henry, and I think the advice for all of us innovators out there, whether it's a small idea or a big idea that we're working on, is really batching it out and trying all these kind of small scale experimentations along the way. Because what I hear you saying is that even when you're 80%, I don't know if my math is right, but you get it, 80% down the path, you still, if you've got to do something different, take a small batch out, test it, then go back to the bigger processes happening versus trying to make this big shift or evolution or decision when there's so much at stake.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, you can't get the whole thing done at once. I mean, this totally makes sense on as far as how you can try entrepreneurial ideas. The thing that's hardest in my brain is when can you flip the trigger to be able to say that I've had enough validation in this side of my concept. And that's something that I don't have a formula for. It's just kind of like gut feel, or enough people have said yes that we should move forward.
Have you ever found that you've tried to overvalidate something to the point where you've killed it?
Oh, all the time. I mean, all the time. I mean, when you grow into having a team, we've got, 25 people that are working for the brewery right now, and there'll be some times where we just get in Rabbit Hole City where we have to step back and be like, guys, we literally can't put any more thought into this. This isn't that hard to figure out, and enough is enough. You know, let's take this 80% and push this forward and then continue to make it better from there.
One of the things that you and I talked about in Madison was how important it is to be able to pivot. Why do you think that's so critical to success in today's marketplace?
Yeah, because it changes that fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know, blame it on technology, blame it on whatever you want. You know, you have to be agile. The world's going to pass you by unless you're able to do that. It's really easy to get comfortable. You know, you've worked so hard to build your startup and, you know, you're finally at the point where you're making some money. Maybe your old crappy car is no longer rusting. You have a nice new one. You know, we've got this like inherent sense that we want to be able to, you know, say this is great because it's running great. But that's the time where the people who were working as hard as you beforehand are now your competitors working that hard, and their new idea is going to come out and surpass you. So being agile to kind of – and one of my favorite – I've been listening to your podcast the past couple weeks was the talk about thinking inside the box.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, that totally makes sense. This is what we do here. You know, and we're trying to come up with all these great new innovative ideas, but we have the constraints of this manufacturing facility that we built. You know, we can't produce certain things that – it's not physically feasible to produce. So taking that approach to it has, you know, helped us guide even some of our most recent decisions in the past weeks.
I love that you brought that up, because I'm totally 100% with you. I get super frustrated when people say to me, we got to think outside the box. I'm like, what does that even mean? And the reality is, when you then bring it back to the constraints and the boundaries that you have, it doesn't work. So, mm-hmm. You know, if you can take the box that you have, think inside of it, I like to think of it as rearranging the box, you have a much greater chance that you can still be super innovative, and you'll have a much better chance of success in the long run than, you know, trying to like go far out and then bring it back.
Yep. Yep, exactly.
So I just have to mention really quickly, because you took our assessment, and I've just been listening to you talk, and I always love it because I kind of can hear the language. So your innovator archetype is imaginative futuristic, and I can hear it in what you're saying. The imaginative side is all about creating new novel approaches, solutions that don't yet exist. You're very good in those blank spaces. I think we've heard it in how you built your business, the leaps that you've been willing to take, the solutions you've been willing to make, that, you know, you weren't just borrowing somebody else's best practice, you were creating them on your own. And then the futuristic, I think that's where part of what helps you be so adaptive and being able to pivot is being able to see into the future. And I don't mean that like a crystal ball. I mean it more like you, someone like you is really good at figuring out tomorrow's solutions. I think most of us get stuck in solving yesterday's problems. Mm-hmm. And to your point, the marketplace is moving so fast that if we're solving yesterday's problems, then we're launching yesterday's products. And somebody else like you is thinking into the future of what can I solve that's going to, you know, the customer's almost going to walk to me versus me trying to catch up with them. And I'm just curious from your perspective, how having that skill of, you know, being able to figure out those transformative solutions and being able to kind of, you know, solve tomorrow's problems has helped you achieve your goals.
Yeah, and I'll say right off the bat that it's been a great thing to launch the company and something that having a great team has helped me keep in check.
Yes, like, that's right. I'm glad you mentioned that. Let's talk a little bit about that side too.
Because I literally have a Google Doc that is Henry's maybe good, maybe bad ideas, and that's where they get to go first before, you know, I call a meeting that we should implement this new thing. So, right. You know, really building a team with people that can, you know, be the level head to your, you know, craziness has been super helpful. But when it comes to coming up with new ideas, you know, you really do need that. It's
yeah.
so hard to look at your other competitors and say, oh, I like how they do this better than me. I'm going to emulate them. Because what are you really going to achieve in that? You know,
right.
they did it well. They're probably going to keep doing it well. Now there's just two people who are doing it well-ish instead of if you come up with your own new way to do it completely. So that's where I like getting stuck in that thinking. And I do that a lot either on the bike riding home or car rides if I have to go really far. But I'll just kind of get lost as the, you know, the highway's going by on figuring out what are these, you know, what's a new way to do this?
Because you're always dreaming into the future.
Yeah, and even down to the ask. You know, I've always asked for this in this manner. You know, what if I change this part of the approach? You know, what if I ask for this? What if my, you know, my last point in the whole sales pitch was my first point? And always just trying to, you know, take subtle variables in and out of it to be better.
I think part of the reason that Mobcraft has such a success is because you're always looking into the future of what's possible. Where should we go next? Because, you know, as you and I were talking about before with the changing marketplace, and you were talking about kind of when you get comfortable, like maybe you have a new car and you're feeling really good. That's one cycle or one curve in business, but you got to figure out the next curve and the next curve. You can't rest on that curve because that curve becomes a cliff. But I just got to highlight what you just said about having your team, because I'm a risk taker experiential, which means I'm constantly leaping and figuring it out, putting stuff into motion. I've got what's called a tweaker on my team, which is all about how do you edit, evolve, shift. So I'm really good at starting stuff. She's really good at figuring out how to actually make it work. So like I need her to balance me, kind of like you need your team to like say, okay, let's work on our challenges today too, Henry, then we'll get to the future. So I love that you mentioned that, because there is such an important interplay between how we all work. But you said something else I want to dig into for a second about, you know, you could follow your competitors and they do it well, so then you do it a little bit weller, you know, but it's versus doing something new. I mean, it's a little bit of a pet peeve of mine of when people do that, because at some point, like, you may make a slightly better tasting stout, but then they're going to make a slightly better tasting stout than yours. And it becomes this leapfrog game that nobody wins, versus doing something new, which, what you're doing with the way you built your company, and actually owning a space. I mean, do you find that to be true, that owning that space is a really, it makes a huge difference?
Yeah, it does. I mean, and to your point on that, making a better and better beer of the same kind, it's like, well, then you just end up in price war, and that's
exactly
good for nobody, you know?
Right.
So, you know, you've got to build something where, and this is, it's so easy to say and so hard to do, you know, you've got to be sticky. You know, you've got to be not just another option, you've got to be the desired option. And that's a ridiculously hard thing to figure out how to poise yourself in that way.
I love how you just said that, though. You don't want to be just another option. You want to be a desired option. So launch readers out there, whatever your idea is, whether you're in a company or you work for yourself, think about that the next time you put something into the market or you're trying to get buy-in from your bosses. I think that was so great what you said. So I want to make sure to ask you about this before we run out of time. You appeared on Shark Tank. And we'll put a link to it in the show notes, because it was such a fun episode or segment to watch. Will you talk a little bit about what you learned from being on that show? Because they loved what you did, and then they grilled you.
Yeah, I mean, so first off, it was a very fun experience. And, you know, with all you know, honesty, we were actively seeking money to build the brewery when we went on the show. And I had pitched probably 10 or 15 different panels of investors around and, you know, just nose after nose after nose. And it's like, we want to build this brewery. And one day I get a call from Shark Tank Casting and they're like, we read about your batshit crazy brown ale in this Yahoo Foods article on coffee beers. And I'm like, huh, all right. This is great.
Oh, they reached out to you. Interesting.
Yep. So that was like, awesome. I mean, I remember I was walking outside of a liquor store, you know, in Madison that I had just got done selling some beer to and had this, you know, 20-minute conversation with Shark Tank.
Cool. Like, I'm not going to lie. I'd feel so good about myself if that were me.
Oh, yeah. We were on cloud nine for sure. So, we went through the whole, you know, their whole application process and whatnot. And pretty similar to the pitch that I had been giving to investors anyways. And like when I actually got down to the dealing with investors, well, I'll back up, the scariest thing in the world was you're standing behind the doors and you've never seen the sharks before. You know, the instructions are the doors are going to open up. You walk forward. There's an X on the ground. Stand in that X and then start your pitch.
Oh, God, no pressure.
So, I mean, that was unique and mildly different than the cameras pointing at your face.
Right.
But, you know, it's kind of crazy that the questions are kind of the same. From different investors, you know, they're still trying to take the same, you know, your 30-second pitch and formulate viable questions to want to learn more about the concept later. So I saw a lot of similarities there. The only things that were pretty different were a little bit of acting here and there by some of the judges. But
Well, they got to keep the show interesting, I guess. Like what?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't need Mark Cuban to spit out one of our awesome sour beers on the stage, but, you know, that was kind of funny.
Do you think so? They loved the uniqueness of how you come up with flavors and that whole process. And then they struggled a little bit with your distribution model. What did you take away from that part of the conversation?
Yeah, one of the investors that was kind of pushing for us to be a contract manufacturer, I mean, that makes complete sense to be a marketing company selling a brand of beer. But when you're trying to build a company that is built on personality and built on me, the brewer, turning your ideas, the customer, into a beer, you know, it takes a little bit, you know, of that authenticity away to say, yeah, we do this, but your beer gets made over here. Let alone the amount of frustration we had for the past 2 years before that, operating in that type of a relationship. Some of our beers, you know, like we've got this sour cherry candy sour that's just about to come out right now.
Oh.
It's been aging on 900 pounds of cherries for about 8 months.
Wow.
You know, we're planning on it being a 4-month beer, but, you know, we're slowly seeing better acidity development and the flavor's getting better. And, you know, so the beers that we make aren't necessarily tied to a manufacturing plant's timeline. It's got to be pretty flexible. So once we decided we want to stick to our guns, obviously we need to build this brand, we need to build personality, but then also getting that manufacturing schedule to meet up with the beers that we wanted to produce was really important.
I think what I love most, Henry, about what you've built is you've built an experience from start to scratch. So most of the time, that experience starts when I buy the beer, or maybe I go to the store and I look at the label, or maybe it comes off the tap. But for you, I'm part of that experience from the beginning, which I think is just, it's so cool and just such a different way to look at it.
Yeah. And it's so much fun to be able to get, you know, because there's so many review sites out there that people are writing beer reviews, and, you know, to go out and look at those and see people who are, you know, there was a guy named Jeff Coleman who was out in Fort Collins. He was one of our winners last summer. So we got to go down there, launch his beer, get all of his friends to try it. And, you know, now he's thinking about potentially opening up a tap room or joining a brewery team. So, you know, every time we launch one of these beers, the crew that helped back the beer in whatever state it is, you know, that's a pocket of a little bit of Mobcraft brand awareness that we hope to continue to grow towards in the future. We've been, over the past 2 years or so, taking the fan favorite beers and brewing those again and again for the traditional distribution side of things.
I have to imagine some people try just to think, oh my gosh, I've got to try that flavor. Like, what is that about? And then they just get hooked on the whole concept. I mean, that must happen all the time, right?
Yeah. I got a funny call from a guy in Florida. I was just down in the tap room, and, you know, people don't really know which place to call the office or the tap room, but so our shipping just got taken away, and we had launched a new vote where there was no possibility to ship beer. And he was like, Henry, thanks for picking up the phone. I'm having a crisis here. Mobcraft is my favorite thing. Every month I go out and I vote on this beer, and now you can't send me the beer. I'm going to have to go hit the Xanax or something like that. It's a hilarious concept of, like, you know, he's like, I love this every month, but now you're taking it away from me.
Oh my gosh.
So we're glad that we got shipping back online, but having fans like that is just great. And once they get out to the brewery to physically brew the batch of beer with us, I mean, that's you know, just a super fun day. You know, it's like kid in a candy shop. You know, when you're a brewer and or a beer fan, you know, of course you want to hang out with the brewmaster and see how the beer is made. We just did one this past Sunday called the Queen Hazel. That a guy named Leo came up from Chicago to brew with us, and you know, it's just that building experiences, making new friends in that realm, and having a blast.
I have to imagine that also having these kind of wide-eyed, excited advocates, customers, just enthusiasts of what you do coming into your brewery and to help with the actual process, in turn actually energizes your staff, the people behind the scenes, to stay motivated too. Because, you know, I think for those of us, even when you're in a super innovative field, you know, the day-to-day of it all can kind of drag you down after a while. You stop remembering the impact you're making, why people are so excited. But with your customers constantly coming in, I've got to imagine it's like this beautiful virtuous cycle of energy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I love our marketing team's conversations with the brewers, because we have like a standing, take a picture, send it to Sam, it goes out on Instagram. So she's building this great Instagram daily feed of, you know, all of the stuff that the brewers are doing. So we've got spontaneous fermentations going on here. We've got Andrew doing cell counts, you know, down in the lab under the microscope, and all this content's coming from the brewers. And that's just normal, mundane, their job that they have to, you know, take a yeast sample. But like, this is the cool, nerdy parts about the brewery. So it's very fun to get that out to people and, you know, see people respond to all the inner workings as well.
Yeah, well, there's a whole, I mean, you've really pulled back the curtain. As we said in the beginning, you put the customer and the consumer in the driver's seat in a way that I'd say most companies don't, regardless of the industry that they're in. And this, I think, is something for Launch Streeters out there to think about is, you know, we tend to make that customer interaction either the point in time of sale, or it becomes this point in time exercise. Let's go out, gather some feedback, and then go back into the conference room, right? Analyze the feedback and then make a decision, where you've really made you've broken down that wall. The consumer has just simply become a part of your business.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You're like, yes, that's exactly right, Tamara. Just yes, what she said.
Yeah, I mean, exactly what you said. I mean, it's this direct emotional connection side of things that, you know, getting that customer on board with you. And, you know, that's where you can make yourself something that's wanted more than just another item.
Yeah.
You know, you're curious. I want to know how that beer turned out. I interacted with that beer online. I'm interested to try it.
Well, the other thing that I find interesting is, so I've tried a couple of your beers because, you know, you were nice enough to gift me some in Madison and I downed them. But that's, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. That's beside the point. But the other thing that I have to imagine that happens is, because you're constantly experimenting, I, as your, you know, loyal enthusiast, totally connected to you, I'm okay if one of them doesn't work for me, because I know that your experimentation is part of your business. Is that, do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, it is. And there's a really fine line between that, because there's personal preference and then there's quality issues. And so there are a lot of times out there where, you know, you'll go to a brewery and you'll not like some beers and not like others because of the flavors that are in them. But then there's other times where it's like, oh, this was just made in a bad way. You know, so whenever we get that feedback from people, you know, we definitely make sure to probe and ask. It's like, well, what, you know, is this because, you know, I hated the jalapeno hopper. Well, why? Because I'm allergic to jalapenos. Okay, all right. That was not something that's on our end. You know, that was definitely something on the, you know, on the end consumer end. But a lot of times we'll just get, you know, feedback of, that one was interesting. Glad I got to share that with all of my friends. But, you know, that one might not be my desired style forever.
I think that's an important insight, though, of, you know, there's a difference between quality control and this just doesn't work for me. And if your consumers understand, like, if you don't have the quality issue and it's just about this one worked, this one didn't, they're willing to go along for the ride. But they're not going to let you have quality issues over and over again.
Yep, exactly.
So where can people go to connect with you, learn more? I think in specific, if I want to start, you know, becoming a part of the experience, where do I go? If I want to buy, where do I go?
Yeah, definitely. So mobcraftbeer.com is our website. We've got an active vote going on right now until the end of the month, as well as I think three other previous winners that are in the final stages of their process before they go out. So that's another thing we do once the vote closes. The beer is available for sale until it sells out or it gets packaged. So we've got the Dudism coming out in a couple weeks, which is a white Russian stout.
That's
the dude. So fun beers up there to check out. And then myself, if you want to shoot me I'm on Twitter at Henry_Schwartz. Instagram is MobcraftHenry. And my email is henry@mobcraftbeer.com if anybody's got specific questions.
We will put links to all that in the show notes. The final question for you is, what's one piece of advice you would give all those Launch Street innovators out there trying to shake up a crowded category?
I would say, what would you do if you weren't afraid?
Mm.
And then do it.
Just shove that afraid deep down and go do it, damn it.
Yep.
I think as entrepreneurs, that's what we do every day, right? I have this fear. Yeah. I'm still moving forward.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for coming by Inside Launch Street. It has been really not just a joy to talk to you, but really insightful about how you think differently about how to bring an innovation to life.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And I look forward to listening to more shows in the future.
I'm looking forward to voting. I'm going to go do that when we're done. Okay, before you go, did you hear how Mob Craft Beer's entire business model helps them rise above the noise? How can you do that? It's as I say in one of our innovation on-demand course lessons, it's got to be defendable and ownable. That's the space that you want to play in. That's the space that Mob Craft Beer figured out how to create for themselves. So if you want to play in that space too, do yourself a favor and go check out our innovation on demand courses and packages. Don't make it hard for you. We've got the information to get you on the right path. They'll have you carving out your own space in no time. Just go to launchstreet.com and click on innovation on demand to learn more. You've heard me say it before. Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.